A lot from a chapter that we have written just recently that is going to be a part of an watershed discipleship anthology that Ched has been editing and recruiting young folks who have some demonstration projects connected to watershed discipleship. In this workshop, we are going to talk about carnival history and the social function of carnival, and then we're going to talk some about Carnival de Resistance specifically, and talk about how this project, we see it acting like a disturbance event relating to disturbance ecology and how disturbance supports diversity and the thriving of certain species. Yeah. And then we'll go into some talk back time.
Yeah. So, thank you guys for being here. If anyone still doesn't know, my name's Jay Beck. And this is my wife, Tevin East. And our project, main project, what you saw this morning, if you were here this morning when we were in character and costume, was an excerpt from one of the four shows that we run inside of our project, which is called the Carnival de Resistance. So I want to get started with just kind of harvesting some people's notions. When you hear the word carnival, what do you think of? What comes to mind? Just shout it out, popcorn style.
Mardi Gras.
Yeah. Caramel corn. All right. I never got that one, but yes. Games. Yeah.
Brazil.
Music. Cool. Yeah, all those things are very, very true. And you can, I wanted to start with a quote that comes to mind that really frames how we're drawing on this tradition. So there's lots of different interpretations of those carnival people. Responses I've gotten back in the past have been circus, or you know, the traveling sideshows and freak shows, but also the bigger and older thing is more along the lines of the Mardi Gras and the Brazil connection of it's a feast day. It's a Christian feast day that comes now, is usually only remembered or in Catholic circles and very rarely in any places in America, but it's the last day before Lent. So it would be the big party that is in the old, the word carnival means farewell to flesh or goodbye meat. And so carne, like the same word of what Ched was talking about this morning with incarnational stuff, becoming enfleshment. This was both when in the medieval times, everyone was going to abstain for 40 days throughout the Lenten period from meat, from sugar, from dairy, from chocolate, from all of the good things of life to enter into the suffering of Christ, remembering those wilderness temptations, fasting and praying. In the old feast day of it, it was that last big party, and it had a because most people were, or all people back then, had to be Catholic whether they wanted to be or not, it was not allowed, and so you had to eat all the meat, drink all the, because it would go bad, and so it was the last big feast day, but it has a very deep subversive tradition that has ran through it since the beginning that we're going to get into a little bit. And for that framing, I want to call on this quote. Figuring out the tech of this stuff. So tech, what did Ched say tech meant today? Traditional ecological knowledge? T-E-K. Yeah. Well, I have it here, too. It'll come up in a moment. But I wanted to start it out with, is anybody familiar with Eduardo Galeano? He is a activist writer from Uruguay who is an amazing activist and poet and novelist. But he says in a book he wrote called Upside Down, A Primer for the Looking Glass World, he said, we live in a world already turned on its head. A desolate, de-souled world that practices the superstitious worship of machines and the idolatry of arms. An upside-down world with its left on its right, its belly button on its backside, and its head where its feet should be. In this upside-down world, children work, development impoverishes, the poor pay the rich, and people are bombed in order to be liberated. In this grotesque looking glass wonderland, free speech is paid for, cars are in the streets where people should be, public servants don't serve, free trade is a monopoly, the more you have, the more you get, and a handful of the global population consumes a majority of the resources. So if the world is upside down the way it is now, wouldn't we have to turn it over to get it to stand up straight? And that is the tradition of carnival. It is the topsy-turvy. It is the upside-down world that really begins in the Christmas story. And you have the incarnation, the very enfleshment of God becoming the lowest, becoming one of the oppressed peoples, and bringing about that emphasis of the Magnificat and the Feast of Fools has a very big connection to it as well. So here's some of the slides that I was talking about, some of the things we might remember when we think about carnival. There was the traveling American carnival that was a lot of times the outcasts, people with physical deformities or cultural exoticism on display because they couldn't find work anywhere else, people on the run from the law finding work in show business. And the sense of wonder that came before television, before movie theaters, storytelling of the other that came into town and became the entertainment for the people of that town. So some of those kinds of things come to mind, and the big rides and the games and the fairs of the traditional American carnival. But here is the older tradition. This is a medieval engraving of the Feast of Fools, which came in the whole carnival year used to be Christmas to Lent. That whole time used to be carnival, and it began with the proclamation of the Magnificat when Mary's song, when Jesus is in her belly, says, he has brought down the rulers from their thrones, but has lifted up the humble. He has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away empty. So from that very beginning of the Christian story, it was this subversive flipping of the script, this role reversal, that those on high are going to be brought low, and those that are underneath are going to be lifted up. And so there was this battle between carnival and Lent that went on, even in the liturgical sense, and there actually was a feast day called the Feast of Fools that, of course, eventually got suppressed by the church, who was also in charge and on their thrones and the hierarchy, and didn't want that verse to get sung. But they would perform it creatively in liturgy, mocking the ecclesial rulers, and they would process in with a donkey, and they would all be making animal sounds in the church. They would crown the jester as the king. All of this role reversal of flipping the script connected to the Feast of Fools, also from the 1 Corinthians verse where it says, "The you know, becoming a fool for Christ, and that the wise are, and the foolish, the foolishness of God being higher than the wisdom of men." And so all of that role reversal stuff, and it got whittled away and whittled away until it was, yeah, that's just going to be one day before Ash Wednesday. And then, and where it used to be months of embodying this role reversal and flipping the script in this mostly European Catholic tradition where the peasant class, the underclass, were allowed to mock the kings, the rulers, the bishops, the church hierarchy because of Christmas and the Magnificat, and because of this older story, that's what it is all really about. And of course, there's also traditions that have been before pre-Christian times that it resonates with in those areas. The roots of the Italian carnival, which is a big one in Venice, drew from Saturnalia and Bacchanalia, which was ancient Roman and Greek festivals that also had a lot of rebellion and flair, and were also connected to abolishing class distinctions. That was the one time a year where slaves and masters switched roles, and the norms and the laws that normally governed sensible behavior were abolished. And so carnival as a feast day and a tradition has been used by people groups all over history and cross-culturally as a way to speak truth to power. And you can see so this is Venice. So maybe that's the iconic image that a lot of European traditions are familiar with, the court jester, the fool, the master of wit, who is actually a position in the court, who is allowed to make fun of the king to his face, sometimes with retribution, but most of the time the king didn't even get that he was being made fun of, and the people did. So here's Brazil. That's the biggest party in the world. That's the Sambadrome. And so Brazil especially gets known as like carnival, home of carnival. And of course, where African peoples through the diaspora were taken to the Americas and the Caribbean, it flourished enormously because of what I just said. They saw in it the potential to speak truth to power, to keep their cultural traditions alive inside of an oppressive forced upon Catholicism. They're like, well, here's this feast day where we're remembering that the high ones are going to be flipped over. And of course, Protestants, you don't find this at all in any of those traditions. One of the biggest things that was the difference between what happened in the African diaspora through the slave trade is in Central and South America, which were predominantly Catholic-controlled colonies, they didn't fear the slaves' use of some of their cultural forms, especially the drumming and the dancing. And so they thought of it as like, let them blow off some steam and they won't get mad at us. So they let them keep a lot of their cultural traditions, which is why you still have a pretty huge rhythm culture in South America and the Caribbean. And of course, seeing solidarity with the natives in those places who also had drumming and dancing traditions and were also oppressed, and a lot of that stuff mixing in that you'll see with that, where in North America, which were predominantly Protestant controlled, they were scared to death of letting the Africans keep any of their cultural traditions and outlawed the use of drum and dancing, except in New Orleans, which was Catholic. And New Orleans actually had a place. So this is Trinidad, which is another big carnival, very crucial to the cultures there, the calypso and the soca rhythms and the processionals, similar to Brazil, how they, it was able for them to keep their traditions alive subversively inside of a oppressive, dominant culture. And so much so in Trinidad now, the carnival bands are like one of the biggest ways that they teach culture and remember their history. And so even though carnival was a European Catholic feast day, the resonance of it to a oppressed people group situation allowed them to keep their cultures alive inside of it and to continue to speak truth to power. And so here's New Orleans and Mardi Gras down there, as Mardi Gras is the French way of saying carnival. It means Fat Tuesday, so it's the day before Lent, the day before Ash Wednesday, which is when Lent begins. This picture is of the Mardi Gras Indians, which has a very powerful history of a similar what I was just talking about. A lot of them claim that their heritage is escape African slaves who fled to the native resistance, mostly Seminole and Choctaw, and were harbored by them and brought up in the tribes who were also resisting imperial oppression. And and remembered that history. And so there are a lot of, there's a tradition in New Orleans that call themselves the Mardi Gras Indians, and they mask African-looking people, masking with traditional native style, kind of with their own flair. And they used to, literally fight over neighborhoods in New Orleans, but now it's more of an artistic battle and a way to remember cultural and heritage and the way they kept their spirit up in the midst of that. And it's still a huge tradition. And even today, as I'm going back and looking at my own ancestral stuff, anybody got an idea where those guys come from? The one on the right is from Italy. The one on the left is from Sweden. So there's a lot of interesting cross-cultural pollination that it isn't easy to talk about carnival from one perspective or the other. It's always been this cross-cultural mix, started as a predominantly medieval European feast day that the underclass took, and then oppressed cultures in lots of places used the form to highlight their own oppression, to keep their cultures alive. And now going back, this is getting a resurgence of older earth-centered European communities who are using the carnival tradition again today. These pictures were just taken a couple years ago of a resurgence of an earth-based tradition that's coming back from Europeans saying, we have lost our own land-based connections, and we used to have these tribal traditions for ourselves. And so they're masking up, they're wearing the animals connection, they're wearing the plant connection, and when are they doing it? During carnival. The one time where that liminal space is being remembered not just as a political subversive, but also as a way to reconnect to their ancestral ways of reconnection to the earth and to the animal spirits and the plant spirits there. Just because it's a day where people are still allowed to put on a costume, they have broadened it and deepened it to say, here's the avenue where we can begin to feel this again and live it again. And so there is a lot of historical stuff with it. And then this is a man named Max Harris who wrote a book called Carnival and Other Christian Festivals. Because I feel like a lot of places I go when we talk about carnival, people don't think of it as a Christian festival, or they think of it as body party where everybody gets drunk and has orgies and beads and booze and all that stuff. And that is the commercialization side of what has happened, even though it has those connections in a deeper way where it was under a repressed culture. It was the day where we were allowed to be wild and free and say no to those older repression against the body, against women, against dancing, against drumming, against sexuality, against all the reproductive earthiness of who we are. Carnival was that day there. It said, yes, we're saying goodbye to it tomorrow, for Lent, but we have to remember that, like, this is part of our spirituality, this incarnation, this embodiment. And so the fact that it hasn't died out says something. And I like this quote from Max Harris where he says, far from being that historical relic, carnival has deep political significance for the present time. And that these folk celebrations with roots that reach back to medieval times or earlier, that they still are remaining vibrant in this high-tech culture of the 21st century, strongly suggest that they also provide an indispensable vehicle for expressing hopes, fears, and desires that people can't articulate in any other way. And if we pay close attention to the signs that are encoded in those folk performances, we can find in these festivals a theology of social justice. Then we think about those social functions. What were the social functions that were happening? And a lot of it has come to my understanding through reading Mikhail Bakhtin. If people are familiar with him, he's a Russian literary guy who wrote a lot about a novelist named Rabelais, who had the sense of the carnivalesque, and he viewed the carnival in its social function and also as a literary mode. But the things that he brought out in that were that carnival was participatory and communal. It was a way to preserve cultural memory, that it had that flipping the script, the mockery and the humor were one of the best nonviolent ways for oppressed cultures to confront social hierarchy, that it was either the peasant class mocking the church and the state, or the slaves mocking the masters. And a lot of that has to do with different masking traditions. In Europe, in Venice, and in the old ways, when there was all this hierarchical class stratification, masks were predominantly used for disguise. But for the low class, that was a huge deal, because on that one day or that one season a year, you can't talk to somebody as if you're above them if you don't know who they are. Behind the mask could be the bishop, or it could be the mayor, or it could be a slave. And so the one day where they're allowed to say anything because they're masked gave them an opportunity to speak truth to power. And then on the other side of it, a lot of African and some native traditions that I've learned, their masking traditions weren't necessarily about disguise, but were about giving a visible presence to an invisible reality. So a lot of their masks were not about hiding who the person was, but about giving a face to a spiritual concept or an ancestral concept or an elemental concept that usually is invisible, and was able to then speak on behalf of those archetypes or deeper spiritual truths. And then again, the incarnational part of the carnivalesque is always connected to the grotesque, this embodiedness. And Bakhtin talks about the lower bodily strata is what is being remembered and celebrated in that. So we have a lot of dirty jokes are allowed, right? Everybody's sexuality is expressed, defecation, copulation, sweat, mocking, which, you know, in back in those times when, you know, Catholic European, you know, cleanliness is next to godliness things, those were all mocked. And, you know, there's feces being thrown around and, you know, public orgies, and it might seem hedonistic to a certain extent, but the point was in that repressive society to say, this is what we're made of. This is where life comes from. This is the, you know, seed and the water and the what our bodies are made of. And that reconnection to the earth in that hilarious way of kind of frightening the higher classes' fear of being dirty, reminding them that they're made of mud. And so you have that celebrational and immediate and a free space, what some people call the TAZ, the temporary autonomous zone, as the church kicked it out of the liturgical stuff when it got too crazy and they felt their own power being threatened, it moved to be a street festival. And that, and the poor people mostly would embody it through parades and games and masking traditions, crowning their own king, the king of fools. And that emancipatory spirit of carnival is always transgressive and invocational at the same time. It's resisting the dominant order, and it's generating some kind of lived alternative, even if it's only for a day. And both are needed for the spiritual and psychic recovery work that are crucial to a paradigm shift. And so as we have been studying that as artists and seeing that in a lot of the music that I apprentice myself to and the dance work and the artistic reflection work, we saw in this tradition that here's an opportunity. We need to re-inhabit this feast day. We need to bring it back as a way to help us shift that spiritual psychic recovery work. If we want our paradigms to shift, it's not going to be just intellectual. It's not going to be just resource management. It's got to be ceremony. It's got to be artistic. It's got to be liturgical. It's got to be embodied. And so.
So, imagine a band of holy fools living between worlds, threading church into big top dream and big band protest, creating space to deviate from the norm, to shapeshift through characters, to reapproach the old sacred stories from the groan of creation to a radical reclamation of the earthy truth within the gospel narratives. These are topsy-turvy, tightrope walkers entwined between the worlds of faith, art, and activism. Dream makers jesting on a grand scale, this cross-cultural and mixed media inspiration surges at the intersection of ancient and contemporary, of flesh and spirit, resounding in mythopoetic, syncretistic voices of the sacred. They weave the elements, let the symbols speak, and call all to dance with the drum. Aspiring to such is this experiment called the Carnival de Résistance. And we are going to now share with you one of the theme songs of our project.
So we begin our theaters this way with this little song that goes, the whole world like our hearts is now filled with burning the wheels of our carts in this great turning move to the rhythm of our souls yearning. Hope for resurrection, that things must die to live again. New genesis from empire's endless blessed decay now makes the way for the Holy Spirit of change will rearrange the dynamics of power. Up from the compost comes a flower. Ancestral voices with roarings and squawks. The dead will rise. The dry bones will walk. It's the Carnival de Resistance. Yes, it's time for the upside down way. When we laugh in death's face and put the kings in their place. For this is the fool's way to pray. All of us under its spell. We know it's real, we can feel it.
Carnival de Resistance, it's time for the upside down way.
When we laugh in death's face and put the kings in their place, for this is the fool's way to pray. Thanks for clapping along.
Yeah.
That is usually much better with all the creepy accordion stuff. We don't even like this.
So, the Carnival de Resistance, in its full expression, we build a carnival world that includes a carnival big top, carnival midway, and a village demonstration project. And so far, we've been able to do this in four locations. The top left corner is Harrisonburg, the first time we ever built the Carnival World.
Virginia.
In Virginia, Harrisonburg, Virginia, and down in Charlottesville underneath. And then we were at Wild Goose Festival last year in 2014. And then we just a few weeks ago rebuilt the Carnival World in Charlotte, North Carolina. Also, earlier this year, we went to the Festival of Radical Discipleship in California, Ched's 60th birthday bash, which was a really good time, and that's when we got to see the Arch Squiship with his flock of holy mackerels around him. It was quite a good time. So I'm going to sort of talk you through what this looks like. When we convene and build the whole carnival world, We live outside, feeling the weather, sleeping on the ground. We build our carnival village, which includes a fossil fuel-free kitchen, compost toilets, solar shower, which you see up here in the top corner. We are working together to make this a reality. It takes a lot more time to prepare coffee for 20, 30 people in the morning when you're doing it over a stove, over a rocket fire, a rocket stove, which is fueled by twigs. So we have folks who are collecting twigs, folks getting up early in the morning. We are washing with foot pump water stations and keeping our kitchen going. It takes a lot more love. It also takes a lot more play and imagination and cooperation. Here you see the riffraffeteria and our village papa, John Felton, in the lower corner. And we have done well. We've eaten well. We get food from local farms. We also do a good deal of dumpster diving, getting local folks to give us cues about the dumpsters that often have a lot of good food in them. Another one of our energy experiments is our bicycle-powered sound system that we put together for the shows. We get the volunteers to come, volunteers from the audience to come and participate, and are able to talk about the generative and healthy alternatives to our systems, our current systems, which are so destructive. Say, we could blow up mountains, dam rivers, or frack, or we can find these other ways that will support our health and well-being and take participation and help us bond. It was kind of magical. There were people who would come night after night, actually, just to bicycle and feel like they're helping the show happen. So there's this formative aspect of living together, but the first year in 2013, we also bicycled between our two residencies, and this was something that was a big leap of faith for us. We didn't really have a bicycle organizer, and we didn't really have many folks who had experience bicycling long distances, and there were some bumps in the road, but we found a way to make it through together and take care of each other and learned a lot more about our capacity and about the provision of peanut butter and water, and that our bodies are stronger than we even knew. So after we get, after these long bicycle rides, then we would start building the carnival world together and building the village. Like I said, that's a, in the top corner we have a broken clock tower that has been the centerpiece of our midway, where we are smashing clocks on the half hour, and where we draw the audience together and invite them to power down, to turn off the devices and move from productive time into mystic dream time or Sabbath time. We of course, pull the village together, and it's, again, this is a deeply formative time that we, just a few weeks ago when we did this in North Carolina, someone at the end of the night said it was 20 people and their hands work, you know, working all day long for 10 hours, so this would have taken a month if one or two people were doing it, so seeing the power of our combined effort. And then we invite people into the midway once it's all constructed. And so The midway is a time where there is lots going on. There are performers roaming about. This is from the first year, one of our jugglers and one of our puppeteers entreating folks.
It's called the midway traditionally in the traveling carnival language because it was midway between the threshold and the big top. So it would be this liminal space before you get into the where all the big shows are.
So here are some more recent pictures, just the way we are keeping this dream space alive, and we work to develop these characters so that folks understand when they move through the threshold and into the midway that they are in another space, in a dream space. And this is one of our first large puppet stilt creatures, the behemoth, one of the mythical beasts from scripture that we were bringing out to help us remember that there is this narrative about wildness, even within our own tradition. And also within the midway, we have games. And these games are themed around environmental justice or stories of resistance within scripture. These are playful storytelling tools where even stories that are familiar to some, we invite them to reconsider the power of these messages. So in the bottom left, we have Through the Eye of the Needle Frisbee Toss, which is a really hard game. And if you unload your material possessions out of your pockets, you get to step a little bit closer, which helps with the game. On the lower right, it's driving the money changers out of the temple. And we remind folks that, in fact, Jesus, in John's gospel, built a whip, and there is gold all filling the foyer here. And up on the top, this is the knock down the walls of oppression. See, these are not tremendous props. These are things that we've, most all the midway games are stuff that we pulled out of dumpsters and repurposed. But the trick with this one is you toss a little heart pillow, and we say, use your love to knock down the walls of oppression, and the heart pillow's kind of light and soft, and it just kind of bounces off the cans and doesn't quite work. And we say, oh, what you need is community. And so we pull out this big, heavy pillow, and that takes a few people that you need to work together to toss out and knock over the walls of oppression. And at the top is the knocking off the head of the corporate Goliath. And these are four of about a dozen games. Also within the midway, we have sideshow acts. So we have barkers who are calling folks to come in and participate with these acts. We have the amazing man eating plants.
You're going to have to come to find out if
you're going to have to come to figure to find how scary this sideshow act is. Also here on the bottom right, that is our Joker's Wild, who has a deck of cards that when you pull out a card, it has an invitation of how you can rewild right now. So he's entreating people into this participatory thing that we were talking about with Carnival. We have the GMO Freak Show. Down here we have our friend who has been picking up magic since he got involved with the Carnival, and he is nearly mind-blowing, fantastic. What is he?
Ascaladin the Slightly Magnificent.
Ascaladin the Slightly Magnificent.
He's a legit magician. He's just humble.
Yeah. And one of the new ones this year was Big bongo and his bizarre bits of biblical booty, where you can come in and relate to sacred relics that are point you to parts of the scripture that amuse and confuse. And as I said, within the midway, we have the broken clock tower, and here we have some children who are together working to smash a clock pinata. So fun ways of getting folks involved in considering how this works. We also generally have a resource table for further learning, and where we highlight some of the local issues. We have had local folks running those resource tables at times to let folks learn more while they're in this sort of playful space. And then after all of this time in the midway, we enter the big top. Also historically, as we enter the big top, we give the mic first to a local artist to sort of set the stage for us and to get to speak to what is happening locally or just share. All of these shows, as Jay mentioned, we have four shows that focus on earth, air, water, and fire. So a different show for each element. We see these shows as ceremonial theater. We also use the term liturgical variety act shows. So we see these shows as following an arc where we move from Thanksgiving and honoring the ancestors, naming the place that we're in, into grief and lament, into holding and handling the mystery, sort of teaching time that has been sort of me and Jay's theater pieces, into some communal ritual where we get people to actually relate to the element. And then into a dance party where we get to sort of let out this cathartic release together once we have journeyed through this experience. So the Earth show, here are some images from our liturgical variety act show, from some of the lament pieces. You're going to look at turning the lights out. That's a good idea. Can we turn these lights out? These right here? Yeah. So on the right, we have, that's great. We have these tree stilt women who are helping us understand the lament of the cedars of Lebanon, the cedars, the cypress. And we have a oak tree woman. We've been developing our props and have really working to have this embodied piece move throughout the show. So while we have awesome music that Jay is coordinating with some really talented musicians, beautiful liturgy and prayers throughout the night. Everything has this visual embodied component. On the Earth Show night, Jay and I spend more time focusing on the Cedars of Lebanon, drawing heavily from Jed's scholarship, which has always been important, as sort of given a compass to our work, and also integrating the poetry of Jim Perkinson.
Specifically with that one, Chad, if you're not familiar with Chad's work on the Blood on the Cedars, it's about the Isaiah 14's prophecy around when empire falls, the trees themselves will rejoice. So even back in our own tradition, the prophet's speaking against deforestation and showing that it's always been in there.
Isaiah the Lorax. So then, water show, y'all have experienced, y'all have experienced some of the water show. We are integrating props, and people actually receive a water blessing at the water show, so we get to feel the element, and as we all know, to touch and be touched by, to drink water is a very real, visceral experience. And I don't need to tell y'all too much about the water show because you got to experience some of it last night. But we've had the good fortune so there's some from the Variety X show. We've got the good fortune to get to do this in a number of locations now. In the air show, Jay and I are drawing on the voices of Raven and Dove, two of the two birds that are featured in the Noah story, the last time the world was destroyed. Raven is a loudmouth doomsday prophet.
That was a really hard character for me to try to do.
And Dove, who in scripture often, well, also embodies the Holy Spirit, is mute. And yet they are communicating. They're having a conversation about how to relate to human activity and the ways in which the earth is threatened by human activity. And of course, Raven says, "Let it burn." But Dove, who is sometimes wounded and sometimes caged, is still hovering over her threatened brood with a hope for its survival. So conversation here between these seemingly opposed ways of relating. And then we have...
And also remembering where these animals come in the other stories throughout our own tradition too. When Raven feeds Elijah in the wilderness and the dove descends on Jesus at his baptism, that these bird spirits are involved with our prophets throughout the stories.
A lot of the theater pieces that Jay and I do, which I said are the sort of teaching portion or the working with a mystery in the midst of these ceremonial theater shows, they're often working with a seeming duality and then shattering that seeming duality by showing the ways that there is conversation or that these two sides actually fold into each other, inform each other, and intermingle. So, the final show and our most theatrical show is the fire show. Jay is the burning bones of the prophet out of Jeremiah 20. So he's this fearsome talking skull that wielding a flaming wand. Very scary. Groans out warnings of rage and doom to an already burning planet. And then hope is brought in the form of this beautiful pregnant sunflower. Woman clothed in the sun from Revelations 12. And, of course, in Revelations 12, she's this is the image of Mary. So we have stilt walkers, we have fire breathers, we have the burning bush, Moses' story of being honed and initiated in the Sinai outback in North Africa, preparing this work of moving out of bondage into the wilderness. So, and as I said, we end every night with a dance party, and these have worked really well. It is often really inspiring to see it, how intergenerational it is. The people from all sorts of, with all sorts of cultural backgrounds, ready to move and come together and participate in a big dance party. So that is the artistic portion of the carnival. Except when we do a residency in one location, we have these shows happening on the weekends, and then throughout the week, we're going and engaging with the local community, offering services, songwriting workshops, storytelling, magic shows, mask-making workshops for the young and the old. We're going and working in community gardens. We're learning from locals, listening to those who are holding that resistance work locally. And we do our best to leave beauty in our wake. We have always had visual artists involved. And here we have our community place in Harrisonburg, Virginia. We painted a beautiful sign, their logo on their building. We went to the Catholic Worker House in Charlottesville and did a little mini mural that you see here and painted their mailbox and their chicken coop. You know, Jay went and did a drumming workshop with the children at a local school. It's sort of tremendous how much we did together. We also built a tree platform at this permaculture CSA Christian community that is doing wonderful work with refugees and is building a bike path through the town, and they thought it would be really cool to have a tree platform along the bike path. And as I said, lots of painters involved. Dmitry Kadiev, who has been tramping around for 20 years, just painting wherever he goes. He's done murals all over the place. This does not include this huge mural that he did at Eastern Mennonite University and involved maybe 100 students in painting with him. This one in the top right is what he just did. He also did another one on the other side of the building and another one inside the building. In the bottom left-hand corner, that's what we did at Ched's birthday, and up there is what he was painting during the Wild Goose Festival that's now up at the Christian Peacemaker Team's office in Chicago. So, also, we, as I said, we try and connect with the local community, the service organizations, activist organizations, to get cues about what is happening locally with the hope that we can sort of shine our creative light on what is happening. And this enabled us in Harrisonburg to have a parade through the downtown, and it landed us on the stoop of City Hall for a public witness, where we pulled our bicycle-powered sound system and pedaled and gave the mic to different groups to talk about food justice issues, to talk about immigration issues, to talk about alternative energy, talk about conservation issues. There's a group that was working to protect this mountain that was very close by. We also had a parade in the Wild Goose Festival, which is, it's not as necessarily surreal and surprising to see such a thing there, but they very much enjoyed the color that we brought with us to the Wild Goose Festival. So lastly, I want to say that this is not something that springs up out of nowhere, and we are learning. The first two residencies were in 2013, so we're still a young project. We're learning about the formational work that needs to happen within our crew to be able to hold this project together. And so recently, when we were just down in North Carolina, we also spent a week together ahead of time doing the theological reflection, looking at this eco-theology and how that interpretation can bump up against a theology of domination, and preparing everyone to figure out how to hold this conversation when they're confronted or tested about how Christian are we. We talked about carnival history. We did an anti-racism training together, which was awesome and was really helped us deepen and figure out how to do hard work together. Like, that's often where emotions come up and some raw personal stuff comes up. So we started sort of setting the stage for our group together to be able to do this hard work together. We also talked about cultural exchange and cultural appropriation as a group. This is also time for really rehearsing our shows and taking that deeper. We brought in some folks to do training, some performance coaches to help us dig into this work of animating these characters. So that is the Carnival Project. I want to talk briefly about how we are connecting to these ideas around disturbance ecology. Our friend Jonathan McCrae tipped us off to the ties between the social function of carnival, as Jay has outlined, and the natural phenomenon of disturbance ecology, which concerns the dependence of biological diversity on natural disturbance. So the survival of a lot of species is dependent upon things like flood and fire. Do you all know of some of these examples? Like the longleaf pines in the southeast regularly had fires going through, and that enabled the growth of certain trees that then the migratory birds and butterflies appreciated those trees. And of course, now with fire suppression, fires become more of a threat. There's greater danger that has come from our fear of that disturbance, our fear of fire. In California, the chaparral ecosystems thrive after a fire. There's lots of examples with flooding as well. So a disturbance event reduces competition, sort of creating a neutral ground for diversity to thrive. And if this natural cycle of disturbance is interrupted, like in fire suppression, then a critical imbalance can occur. So carnival, if it can function as a disturbance event, it can function as a disturbance event for our social ecology, clearing the space for new growth to emerge, for new growth and social diversity to emerge. We like this quote from Edward Abbey, who is himself sort of a wise, holy fool. He says, "Society is like a stew. If you don't stir it up every once in a while, a layer of scum floats to the top." So we're thinking about how Carnival can function as a disturbance event. So one way is that our ceremonial theater, all these pictures that you saw earlier, they are full of social critique, songs and stories from oppressed people groups, and invocations of the divinity within nature. So we're working to disturb the dominant paradigm of Christian theology. As we said, we highlight biblical encounters with animals or people whose stories were activated by a relationship with creation, like Miriam, like John. So we give voice to and animate the elements. We have received some pushback from theological conservatives who accuse us of being heretical earth worshipers, but we counter this and point to an ancient Christian tradition that regards the power of creation as an active expression of who God is. So, doing this work to disturb Christian theology. The carnival is also disturbing traditional ecclesial models. So, we call this church under the big top. This is liturgy and ritual and community celebrations, and people get wet, right? People dance with a fire. People are asked to breathe in the air show. People are asked to be involved bodily, and we dance it out at the end. So this is in sharp contrast to the traditional and particularly white Western models of church that we kind of believe need to be shaken up. Also, the immersion of the carnival crew within the village demonstration project has been a disturbance event for us, ourselves. Life as usual is interrupted as we go into this communal experiment and work to live in another way. Many of us are trying things for the first time. As I said, cycling long distances or collecting firewood, carrying water, you know, cooking over little fires, handling humanure or dumpster diving. So we fill this month with different rhythms, but we're also working to fill our time with cultural practices, songs, stories. We have a lot of games that we do to keep things playful. We call the village our holy game, where we don't necessarily believe that we're going to get it all right or that this is a program that people need to follow, but this is more like a holy game where if you jump in and you participate and you play along, somehow spirit is going to enter in, come into the mix, and transform us. And we're also looking at this at our sort of public demonstration, the outdoor carnival world, as a cultural intervention experiment. This is a word we got from the Eastern Mennonite University Center for Justice and Peace Building that came and talked to us about what we're doing. Excuse me. So it's a little bit surreal. You know, we're setting up in a neighborhood, in a place where such a thing hasn't lived before, and stirring up the notion of what is possible. Another important note is we work really hard to operate out of the gift economy So to keep this event free to the public, there is no cost of admission. And so this free gift where all are welcome is enough, I think, to disturb some notions of what is possible. And sort of leads us into thinking about the importance of our cultural expressions and how they're related to the health of our natural commons. Here we are, we're talking about the health of the watershed. I'm sure many of you are involved in food justice work. And there is certainly the sense that this work is going to get quite tiresome and drab. And even our political engagement, our resistance work, is going to get formulaic if we are not involved in, if we don't bathe it in song and in cultural expressions that keep us connected to the story of why we're doing this, of what we value, of who we deeply believe ourselves to be. Any other words?
Well, I want to leave some time to just have a little bit of a conversation if people have questions. But yeah, what Tev was saying there at the end, just about how our cultural commons always affects the natural commons, right? So there might even be a disconnect originally. I'm just like, what does this have to do with watershed discipleship? And we even asked ourselves that question because we were like, does it? Is this connected to this other theological stuff we've been learning about rootedness that we think is really important? And how art and liturgy and ceremony and our cultural commons, the way that all of that teaches us how to be, that's what ceremony is about, that's what ritual is about, that's so much education happens in spaces like churches and schools and music and art is always broadcasting how you're supposed to behave, what our inner relations are about, our political formation, our relational formation, our relationship to the land. And from what I've learned from traditional cultures, you know, it's always reinforced and understood through, not through textbooks, but through drama and storytelling and music and ceremony. And so learning from those traditions and looking at that and saying that is an aspect that needs to be recovered because we form ourselves and our behavior is reminded and emphasized and challenged and remembered, and that behavior that's formed through the ceremony and the art making and the communal creativity then reinforces our action and our behavior with the natural world.
So let's see, it is 5:30, so we have 10, 15 minutes for any questions. Maybe I should say that we are in discernment right now about our location for our residency in 2016.
This happens once a year right now, too. Like, just, I know that's... we have 20 or more people in our crew usually, and they all do it for free. And so gathering everybody and coming is a big discernment process, which host community, where we're going to do it.
So we're looking at 2016 and 2017, 2018, and are interested in discerning if Minneapolis would be a location in the coming years, and might be hosting a little talking time, talking more specifically about that. But any thoughts or questions about the project in general or about carnival history?
Fertile ground here. I'm imagining that you're aware of the part of the Beast Puppet, mm-hmm. and the May Day Parade, and mm-hmm. very grassroots artistic expression.
Yeah, we'd love to collaborate with them if we came here, for sure.
I just have a comment. It strikes me that your whole venture is homeopathic. And by that, what I mean is that you're like a tiny expression in the midst of empire. It's geared to be a catalyst, to stimulate the positive forces that begin to ripple out and then affect and heal, you know, that broader context. A lot of people don't understand homeopathic medicine. It's sort of counterintuitive. How can this dinky little thing create a healing in me? But the concept is that it's just a catalyst for what's already in the body that can positively fight against whatever virus or whatever it has. So what I see you all doing is you are being that homeopathic pill that drops into an area and stimulates the positive forces that are already there.
I really resonated with what Sharon Day said earlier about all of the no that she was saying throughout her life with the protest work, and that she needed to be able to say yes and do a generative action. And so that is what Carnival historically is. As Jay said, it's both transgressive and invocational. There's resistance and a generative action all mixed up together. And that does feel really, really important. We're smashing clocks so as to say there is another way of being in time together. There's another way of feeling, being immediate with each other, and feeling that the potency of the moment that we don't have if we're bound up.
I've seen Carnival, and I've talked with you guys some about it, but I'm interested to hear how has curating the Carnival, being the Carnival, how has that transformed the both of you as individuals, as partners, as artists, as spiritual beings. How is it for your discipleship, basically? That's a very personal question.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really loving tracking the ways in which the crew's lives have been seriously transformed by their participation in this project. I mean, some people have taken on new artistic skills that they are exploring. Art that they were not exploring before. Some are doing digging in more into anti-racism work or decolonizing work. I wasn't quite ready to imagine marrying this man until I knew that we could do this, could get through the carnival together. And so once I realized that we could carry this work and remain healthy through the process, then I don't know. What do you say, honey?
I was just going to say, I think it's been probably one of the biggest catalysts for my own personal discipleship, too. That, and it's also made me deepen into skill sets that I've always had interest in or had some natural ability in. And then I was just like, no, you actually really have to know how to be an organizer. You have to, you know, really know how to lead a rehearsal. You have to, you know, and there's a lot of other theological stuff that I wasn't that interested in, but came, and both theological and political stuff that is just showing how everything's interconnected through both the role of being an organizer and a creative leader of it, forming the shows together. Mm-hmm. And like Tev said, with artistry too, so many of the crew members have dove in to, like, people who never did anything like their hobbies or a slight interest, and now they're like going and on like internships with magicians and stilt walkers or going on CPT delegations to, you know, deepen their solidarity understanding.
I also feel like it's helped me figure out how to grow my capacity to hold grief and joy.
And there's been a lot of talk about, it's gotten referred to as a white recovery project by certain members. And I think in the lens of how Pastor Jin was talking about whiteness as a disease, I like thinking about it as not white people recovering, but recovering from the disease of whiteness, where we have a lot of our crew member are people who don't have connection to traditional land-based communal practices and a spiritual understanding that comes from that. And so part of that new learning is where do we do the ceremonial expression and creative outpouring and grief and lament and thanksgiving work that we need to do with this new understanding of our faith if we can't do it in our churches because they either are antagonistic to it or just don't get it and don't know how to shift their paradigm. It's and how do we not just like go, you know, take Native American or African traditional stuff without the long-term relationship of involvement with those communities. So we need to create something that is trying to build those bridges between the elder traditional communities that we see as our elders, but also make a space for those types of experiments for the people who are trying to do it and need to do it, but don't have a space for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead.
I had a conversation you had with somebody about considering more spontaneous and kinds of expressions and adapting what you do to that. And I was wondering if you could just share a little bit more about what that would take and if you consider that.
Sure. Yeah, I think, well, just because he heard my conversation, you can speak to it too. But yeah, it's called de resistance, right? So there's got to be a little bit of pushing the dominant order, and there's aspects of protest work, like we've done we've done parades and stuff, highlighting things. But we actually, when we originally wanted to do that power down, we came and said, like, what's the local protest you guys want to do? We connected with our local host and said, we just want to bring our crazy drums and bikes and outfits and like amplify what you guys care about and want to do in your local area. And they said, we're sick of protests. And so we're like, okay, so you don't want us to do a parade? You know? And so it's always a connection of how do you help the local resistance work. But I do have a desire, and we've talked about this sometime, of doing some more specifically, a lot of carnival is not asking permission, right? Is taking over a space and reclaiming it for the people, doing that disturbance literally and clearing the grounds. Right now, we've been playing it safe to get it off the ground with permits and, you know, tents and somebody who owns the property letting us be on their lawn. And so, because we want to do it and not get shut down. But I think once we get some more things under our belt, we've had a lot of inspiration from other groups like the Carnivals Against Capitals that we were talking about earlier, which happened, anti-globalization movement, also summoning this carnivalesque in London in the 90s. My favorite example is they took over a highway on-ramp and like completely no cars could get through, and there were so many people, the cops couldn't do anything about it, and they had these huge women in giant stilt things with these giant like hoop skirts that went, like they were like probably 13 feet tall, And then they had huge sound systems pumping all this like rave dance party music. So everybody's in the streets dancing. There's these huge women in these ball skirts. And underneath the ball skirts were activists with jackhammers busting up the highway and planting trees. So like, that's like where I want to go, you know, like once we have some more experience.
Yeah, I mean, there's there are ways in which it would be nice just to be pirates.
Yeah.
With this configuration, the fact that it takes almost 2 days to build and to break down, we don't have the ability to move quickly, so we're not risking being shut down. It's possible that we'll have a smaller contingent, hope maybe, through the years that can move more easily.
We also want to build a teddy bear catapult.
We have a lot of things we want to build. Yeah.
So when the riot cops are out there, we're just like pelting them with teddy bears.
That's also an idea from another great...
Yeah, there's a great book called Beautiful Trouble that is like a collection of a lot of carnivalesque resistance actions, more and tactics.
Do you have a question?
I wanted to hear a little bit more about if you're willing to share your personal spiritual dreams and how that informed your idea to form the carnival around those four shows having to do with fire, earth, water, and air. Because that, to me, that really speaks to a lot of pagan tradition and the idea of those four elements, and it's interesting to me, so I'm willing to share it.
I
would say, just real quickly, my personal journey has been on a journey to integrate faith, art, and activism, and at different times in my life, I've taken a break from one or the other, like stopped all this art business, and to have a direct impact on the world and go lobby in D.C. and spent some time away from the church. And it has been incredibly healing for me to find the integration of these parts. And part of my healing has been reconnecting to creation spirituality, understanding that the wisdom within scripture is relevant to our ecological crisis. So throughout all of my lifetime, I have continued to feel the presence of the divine within the natural world. So my knitting these pieces together has been tied to that. It has meant being accountable to creation as a teacher, and
I resonate with that too. I think a lot of the and from the theological perspective, you know, that's where we get the conservative pushback, is people say this is pagan, this is idolatry, this is, you know, syncretism, this is spiritualism, heathen, pagan are words that got really bad raps. But what they mean was the folk religion of the people who are connected to the land, as opposed to the imperial cult of the city. And Christianity has both of those versions in play. It's then this conquering imperial, like Chad was talking about earlier, you know, white man in the sky, yeah, docetism. Who is separate from it all, spirit separated from body, and, you know, don't worry about it, the earth's just going to burn, and Jesus is going to bring a new one for the good people. As silly as that sounds, that is actually the dominant religion and has been for hundreds of years. But there's also been this liberation story version of it, too, that's always remembered, and when you read that's really what saved me from not just throwing Christianity away, was finding scholars like Ched and my connection with the African drum and dance community and the Native friends I had who were saying, you know, we don't see that antagonism. We see it with that version of it. But the reading the prophets and finding all these stories where, I mean, the tradition literally starts with God telling exile to go get everybody out of the city and bring him into the wilderness, and God is a talking plant that's on fire. Like, that's Exodus, right? So there's, you know, there's that's it's in the stories in the, in these deep, deep ways. And so that's been the way that I've been able to make those understandings come to be, is seeing it through that lens and getting rid of the colonial goggles that we were all, you know, given at birth and growing up in the dominant culture. So.
And all of these elements show up in a place of transition or transformation within the stories. So there's a crossing of the river, or sleeping on the stone, or the fire shows up, or the voice out of the whirlwind. I mean, these are all the elements make your story come alive, and it's how we get to continue feeling the relevance of the story, because here we get to continue listening to the voice of God and the creation.
Yeah.
I want to just say a tiny bit about what the conditions of a new host place would be, so that you would be ready to transport whatever social conditions or financial.
The conditions, I turned off my mic, so I'm just the conditions are we need a good strong host church. We need a location to build the Big Top Midway Village. We learned just recently that it is important for that to be a Christian context, or closely tied, you know, for a faith community to be tied to our being there, and through them to be able to connect to the other faith communities, local faith communities.
And that usually means a parking lot or a lawn, because it's all outside. Yeah.
We need connections within the local resistance community. We need a local organizer who is going to help make that communication with the local community happen more smoothly. We need a university to be involved. It has been found that it's really helpful to have be able to relate to students. And we need financial support. And we ask for a fraction of what it costs for us to do it. That doesn't mean buy in locally.
What about proximity to, you know, in terms of like how far out?
Right. We do believe that this is an urban project. This is not, while it could be really pleasant to be out on a farm, we want to be able to bicycle to various parts of the community, interact across multiple sections of the community, and for to be in a location that has some visibility and that is easy to get to, whether or not you're
right. We can't expect people to drive out to come to it. We want to be in a neighborhood somewhere where it's...
Lastly, I will say that over here we have a sign-up sheet if you want to get monthly updates about what we're up to. This is what the carnival's doing. This is also how updates on what Jay and I are doing. So we can get those updates. But if you want to get those updates, please share your contact information. Also, I have